On this edition for Sunday, July 5th, a 4th of July weekend marked by a surge in COVID-19 cases, Jeff Greenfield with a look at the political scene, and a spike in drug overdoses fueled by the coronavirus pandemic. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular has been offering no-contract wireless plans designed to help people do more of what they like. Our U.S.-based customer service team can help find a plan that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us. As the United States celebrates the 4th of July this weekend, the ongoing coronavirus pandemic made it unlike any other. As cases of the virus continue to rise in much of the country, some fireworks displays went on, including in Washington, D.C., but crowds were much thinner compared to previous years. In a speech on the South Lawn of the White House before the massive fireworks show, President Trump claimed, without citing any evidence, that 99% of coronavirus infections are, quote, harmless, despite a death toll of more than 129,000 people in the U.S. Mr. Trump repeated his grievances with the media and focused on what he called angry mobs during recent protests against police brutality and racism.
We are now in the process of defeating the radical left, the Marxists, the anarchists, the agitators, the looters, and people who, in many instances, have absolutely no clue what they are doing.
It was the second speech in 2 days where Mr. Trump emphasized themes of racial division, a preview of his re-election message with less than 4 months until Election Day. For perspective on political developments this weekend, we turn to special correspondent Jeff Greenfield, who joins us from Santa Barbara, California. Jeff, if there's an American that is still unclear about how this election is going to turn out, they weren't paying attention for the last 2 days of speeches by Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think we've got a pretty clear clue. It actually goes back to his inauguration almost 4 years ago. He's going to define this election as a choice between someone upholding traditional American values and an assorted group of people who don't like America, don't like the history, want to erase it, are perfectly prepared to let unruly mobs tear down statues, create mini civilizations within cities, and essentially just destroy the country. I think they've made a conclusion that given the state of the pandemic, which is clearly not resolved, given the state of the economy, which was not what Trump hoped it would be going into the election, they are going to say it's I stand between this group of quite literally un-American forces and you, the people of the United States.
Joe Biden has said he's not interested in pulling down statues of Jefferson or Lincoln, and yet here we are yesterday, Baltimore Harbor, a Columbus statue gets torn down.
Yeah, I think incidents like the tearing down of the Columbus statue is exactly, if I can be blunt, what the Trump campaign is hoping for, because it illustrates his point about disorder. It's very hard to paint Joe Biden as some kind of left-wing socialist. If you remember the whole primary campaign, his opponents were saying he's too conservative, you know, too unwilling to make radical changes. So their argument is he will be run over politically by these forces and is incapable of defending you and defending the country. And I have to say, every time something like that happens, where a statue of someone like Columbus or Washington is pulled down, it strengthens his case. And I think that's probably what the Democrats are more worried about than almost anything else right now.
Last week, we saw moves by social media companies starting to put their neck out a little further against the president, or at least enforcing their policies, which end up being against the president in some ways. This week, we saw a few more, kind of dyed-in-the-wool Republicans that were also willing to speak their minds in opposition of the presidency. What's going on?
Yeah, I think this is a potentially significant thing because you're quite right. There are plenty of Republicans who didn't back Trump 4 years ago and have no intention of backing him now. But we saw Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, say very pointedly there should be no stigma about wearing masks. Everybody should do it. We saw the House Republican leader, Kevin McCarthy, say the same thing. We saw Liz Cheney in the House leadership put out a picture of her father, the former vice president, with a mask, and also taking Trump to task about the whole question of were Russians paying terrorists in Afghanistan to kill Americans, and why don't you care? We saw Karl Rove, the famous Republican operative, and Chris Christie, the former New Jersey governor, say publicly, you're on a course to lose. Now, we don't want to make too much of this because Trump is still very popular with Republicans, slightly less so than he was. And he's not at 96%, like he says, but he's doing fine. But if you see this continuing, if Trump continues to falter in the polls, what you see, what you will likely see, is Senate Republican candidates distancing themselves and making the argument, Trump may well lose. You need us to protect your interest in the Senate. That's going to be something to keep a very sharp eye on as we move into the fall.
And speaking of the fall, the situations with the polls in the middle of a pandemic that doesn't seem to be going away, how are people going to be able to cast their ballots? Because in the last couple of weeks, we've also seen the president almost lay the groundwork for a case for fraud, saying, hey, the mail-in ballot system doesn't function, there's fraud everywhere. Again, there's no evidence to substantiate that, but he's making that case. And yet we still have to go to the polls, whether that's in person or by mail.
And look, this is frankly baffling to try to tease out the president's argument. He says absentee voting is fine, but mail-in ballots are rife with fraud. There is no difference. Once you go to excuse-free absentee balloting, which 34 states have, there's no distinction at all. Indeed, five states have only balloting by mail. In a normal situation, this wouldn't even be a political issue. We just saw in Kentucky, where the Democratic governor, the Republican secretary of state, agreed on a big increase in no excuse absentee voting, and they set a record. The problem is that it takes time to ramp this up. And if the pandemic is still with us and millions of voters are uneasy about going to the polls, that could have a huge impact if Republican controlled legislatures follow the president's lead and don't permit an expansion. We also should put on the table the fact that while normally or in other years this has not been a political issue, more Biden voters say they are uneasy about going to the polls than Trump voters. So you can see how that could have a political impact. But the idea that you can draw a sharp distinction between absentee balloting, which the president does, and 30% of Florida voters done it, and mail-in ballots, I just have to say it is as lawyers like to say, Harry, it is a distinction without a difference.
Jeff Greenfield joining us from Santa Barbara, California. Thanks so much.
Good to see you, Harry.
Officials in U.S. COVID-19 hotspots in Texas and Florida are urging residents to stay home to get the virus under control. Hospitals are nearing capacity in Houston, and health departments in two counties in the Rio Grande Valley, Star and Hidalgo, say they are already at capacity. In Florida, 10,000 new positive tests were reported today, bringing the total to more than 200,000 confirmed cases of the virus. Four hospitals in the Tampa Bay area reported that intensive care beds were full. Miami's Mayor Francis Suarez said he is hopeful that recent mandates to wear face masks and fines on businesses will help flatten the curve.
It's clear that the growth is exponential at this point. We've been breaking record after record after record the last couple of weeks. We instituted about a week ago a mask in public rule, and we also increased the severity of penalties for businesses that don't follow the rules. Our county closed down the beaches for the July 4th weekend in the hopes that all these rules will have an impact, a positive impact. It takes a little bit of time.
While some parts of the world continue to reopen after coronavirus lockdowns, confirmed infections are still rising in many places. In India, health officials reported a record number of coronavirus cases over the last 24 hours. India is now only behind the U.S., Brazil, and Russia in its total number of infections. But while cases there are surging, some parts of the country are reopening, including the Taj Mahal. The number of tourists allowed in each day will be dramatically curtailed, and guests will have to wear masks, socially distance, and not touch the 17th century monument. In Mexico, the health ministry reported this weekend that the coronavirus death toll has reached 30,000. That's the fifth highest total in the world. In downtown Mexico City, a strict lockdown was reimposed for this weekend after officials said many establishments did not follow social distancing rules. Businesses were closed, but people were still allowed to walk and gather outside. In Australia, an outbreak of coronavirus cases led authorities to completely lock down 9 public housing towers for at least 5 days. Police will enforce the order for about 3,000 residents to stay home. All will be tested, and food and medicine will be delivered. One of the concerns of COVID-19 is the ability for a small percentage of infected people to spread the disease to a much larger percent. They're known as super spreaders. And with businesses reopening and more summer gatherings taking place, experts worry that super spreader events will only increase the transmission of the virus. I recently spoke with Ben Lopman, professor of epidemiology at Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health, about the data he and his team are studying. What did you and your team go out to study?
We went to study how transmission is occurring in our state in Georgia. We worked with the data that's collected by the Georgia Department of Public Health, and we examined who's transmitting this disease and how many people they're going on to infect.
And what did you find?
Our main finding is that we found evidence of super spreading. Super spreading is where one person or one event goes on to infect many more people than the typical infectious person. We use surveillance data that are collected by the local and then the state public health departments. They ask people their age, they ask them where they were when their symptoms began. And we use that kind of bread and butter surveillance data to do some statistical studies. And in those studies, in that analysis, we found this evidence that some people or some events are much more important in terms of transmission. In a rural county where we did our work, there was a report of a couple of funeral events where there were many documented cases that occurred. Also in slaughterhouses in the north of the state and nursing homes around our state, and has been reported very widely around the country for that matter.
And when you're able to get this statistical data, is this based on, for example, location from cell phones or stuff that's publicly available where you can see clusters of people gathering?
We don't use individuals' cell phone data. However, we did incorporate information on mobility, not directly on the people who were infected, but how people were moving from county to county, for example. And that was part of the data that helped us to understand how transmission is occurring.
Right now, the article is in preprint. For someone who doesn't follow how academic journals work, what does that mean?
That means that our research has not yet been peer-reviewed, and that's an important point. We have a team of investigators that haven't been involved in this research, and we've also been working with our collaborators, for example, at the Georgia Department of Public Health, and we've all been scientifically critical of our work. This pandemic is obviously moving very fast, and academic peer review can be a lengthy process, and so we felt it was important that this information get out there while peer review is ongoing.
And so when you see these super spreader events, is there any kind of demographic data that you can figure out from there saying, hey, it looks like it's people from this group that are doing it and they're going to have ripple effects on these other demographics?
This is one of the really important findings of our research, is that we found that younger people, and that's a pretty big category in our work, people under the age of 60 were more important in terms of transmission than older people. Now, we know that older people bear the burden of this disease, but what we found is that younger people are more important in terms of transmission. So targeting that younger group to stop transmission was probably more important in terms of controlling the epidemic. And it also gives me concern. We are seeing now in many states reporting that the age of cases is younger than it was early on in the epidemic. And so while that might be good in terms of severe disease, it's worrying in terms of transmission.
But what's the implication here? I mean, how do you translate your findings into policy that leaders should be looking at?
No, it's very important. You know, this term super spreading or super spreading events, it sounds ominous, but actually in terms of public health, it gives us a hook of something that we can actually do. We know, for example, that large gatherings are really important in terms of these kinds of events. And so if we target our public health messages there, if we encourage people to not be part of large events, to not go to large events, we can have a bigger impact in terms of curtailing transmission.
Was there anything that surprised you when you looked at all this data?
One thing that was encouraging, actually, was in the very beginning of the epidemic in Georgia, people were going on to infect, on average, about three people. And then as people started to social distance and the lockdown orders were put in place in our state, that number dropped to less than one, which is the number we're targeting to keep transmission under control for the epidemic to be declining. So I think one of the important results of our study is that those interventions had a really big effect on transmission.
All right. Ben Lottman, professor of epidemiology from Emory University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This Independence Day was also marked with protests against racism and police brutality and rallies and marches to remember George Floyd. Trump supporters and protesters at a Black Lives Matter rally in Washington, D.C. briefly clashed yesterday before the president's speech at the White House. Other protests focus on removing statues that activists say are emblems of America's racist past. In Baltimore, protesters pulled down a statue of Christopher Columbus in the city's Little Italy district and dumped it in the Inner Harbor. And a Black Lives Matter protest late Friday night on a Seattle freeway turned deadly when a man drove past a police barrier and into a crowd of protesters, hitting two of them. 24-year-old Summer Taylor died last night from her injuries. 32-year-old Diaz Love remains in critical condition. The driver is in police custody and faces multiple felony charges. China is exerting a new level of control over Hong Kong now by pulling books from shelves. Nine books written by prominent pro-democracy activists are no longer available at public libraries there. The government agency that oversees libraries said it is reviewing the books to see whether they violate a new national security law enacted on Tuesday night. The new law is aimed at so-called troublemakers. The sweeping legislation punishes acts related to secession, subversion, and collusion. Those charged could face up to life in prison. Pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong protested the new security law on Wednesday, calling it mainland China-style censorship. After appointing a new prime minister this week, French President Emmanuel Macron is set to unveil a new cabinet tomorrow. In a press conference yesterday, the new prime minister, Jean Castex, said the new government will focus on keeping French manufacturing jobs and bringing back work from lower-wage countries. Castex called for investment in training and new production tools. The cabinet shakeup comes as Macron's government tries to recover from a deep recession during the coronavirus pandemic. In southern Japan, heavy rains yesterday caused landslides and flooding that killed at least 16 people. More than a dozen others are still missing. Rescue operations are still underway after many people were seen stranded on rooftops. Rivers overflowed, submerging houses and washing away bridges. Rains subsided today, and military troops were sent to help with recovery efforts and the search for survivors. For the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. One of the hidden epidemics in the coronavirus pandemic has been an increase in drug overdoses, with suspected cases spiking significantly in March, April, and May, according to data from emergency medical teams, hospitals, and police. The Washington Post, using data and interviews, reports that as the pandemic continues, the cases of overdoses are accelerating. I recently spoke with Washington Post economics correspondent Heather Long about their findings. Heather, what has been happening with the overdose situation during the pandemic?
Basically, the opioid epidemic is back. Since we went to these stay-at-home mandates in late March in most of the country, we've started to see a really alarming spike in drug overdoses and, in some cases, overdose deaths. What we know from the data that's available, which is mostly from 911 emergency providers, is that cases were up 18% in March, 29% in April, and a really stunning 42% in May. So even as the economy was starting to reopen, there was still this real cry for help with people turning to drugs for some sort of relief.
Has this been made worse by the social isolation?
That's clearly the main driver here. I think about Stephen Manzo. He's a 33-year-old outside Detroit, Michigan. I interviewed him in late March, just after he lost his bartending job. He said to me, "Just sitting at home and doing nothing is anxiety-ridden. We have no idea how long this will last." Unfortunately, 2 weeks later, he overdosed and died. And I think his situation, you could hear it. He was obviously sad about losing his job, concerned when things would get back to normal. But what he really missed was being around people, and especially being around other recovering addicts. He had struggled earlier in life with drug addiction. But all of those support networks have really been ripped away right now during this pandemic.
The funding for mental health, even pre-pandemic, was, well, to put it mildly, abysmal. How are these centers that might be a source of support for that individual or others, how are they coping through the pandemic?
Well, the early indications are very alarming. I think about the Austin Recovery Network, one of the oldest providers in Austin for substance abuse treatment. They unfortunately ran out of funding and had to close some of their overnight shelters. And they've literally had men walking into their headquarters begging them to let them back in, and they don't have beds. And even well-funded groups, some of the ones that do have better funding, I think of the Salvation Army has a large network of recovery centers across the country. I spoke to one outside Detroit, and they said, look, our calls are up 20% of people wanting to come back or wanting to come to us for the first time. But because of health and safety and social distancing requirements, we can't have as many beds right now in our facility. You know, we can only have one person per room instead of maybe two or three. So we cannot offer enough help right now.
Where are people getting their drugs at this point? I mean, it seems that we've also seen indications that drug trafficking has decreased, that demand is suddenly down. What are people overdosing on?
I don't think demand is down. Basically, we're in a situation similar to what happened with toilet paper, where suddenly there was an increase in people wanting these drugs. And at the same time, the supply chain has been disrupted. There's literally reports of drugs sitting on the Mexican side of the border that just haven't been able to be moved across into the United States. And unfortunately, unlike toilet paper, you know, drugs are not all the same. And so what we're seeing is people are getting things that are maybe much stronger than they're used to, or a weird combination. And unfortunately, that's leading to more overdoses.
How do we track this? How do we figure out whether this is a drug overdose? Obviously, when a person dies and if there's a toxicology report, but what's happening now?
That's what's so hard is we want better data, just like we want better data on coronavirus cases and what's going on, you know, hour to hour, minute to minute with that. We would like to know the same on the opioid crisis and the overdoses. Unfortunately, we really don't have that as a country right now. The best data that we have is some counties have agreed to participate in a federal initiative where they send their 911 data in. And, you know, obviously a lot of these people in ambulances and the police, they've seen a lot of these overdoses. They have a pretty good sense of when something is a true overdose. And so they fill that in their reporting. So what we've seen so far is 62% of counties are showing a really alarming spike in drug overdoses. But unfortunately, we don't have data for all counties.
So what are these service providers telling you? How do we reverse this trend, or even just slow it to stop it?
That's a great question. The message that I just kept hearing over and over again as we called around the country is, first of all, recognize this is happening. I think we've all been so focused on the pandemic that we've missed this epidemic. I think another obvious step, we hope in Congress with this next stimulus to give some more funding to these recovery centers and treatment programs. There's a clear cry for help. And the last one, it sounds so basic, but we do have drugs available called Narcan, which can counteract an overdose. It's, a lot of people call it the miracle drug. And the key is getting it into enough people's hands. And what we're seeing, I just learned the state of Michigan, where Steve Manzo passed away. The state of Michigan has just announced that it is going to make for free Narcan available at community centers across the state. Let's hope other states follow suit.
Heather Long of the Washington Post, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III. The Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, Retirement Services and Investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.